I'll call this meeting of the Labor Industry Finance and Policy Committee to order for Tuesday, March 21st. First thing we'll do here is, I understand we have a correction we have to do to the minutes, and Representative Meckland, I understand on the 9th we left off Joe McDonald on one of the roll calls, or Lee McDonald. So do you want to make a motion to approve the minutes as corrected for March 9th?
I will, yes.
Recall them first?
Recall the minutes from March 9th and then move the revised minutes.
Would the minutes have been recalled? And then Representative Meckland makes the motion to approve the revised minutes with the correction that was taken. All in favor of approving the revised minutes for March 9th, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. Now, the minutes from March 16th. Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will so move the minutes from March 16th.
And we didn't
Mr. Chair.
It.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
I have a point of parliamentary inquiry. It doesn't look like Representative Meckland was in attendance that day. Can he move the minutes?
For the 9th?
Yes.
For the 16th, we can't. It's right. You can't. Thank you for that.
Representative
Jordan, you want to move?
So, Mr. Chair, having reviewed the minutes, I move their approval.
Second deadline punchy.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I did actually watch remotely.
Anyway, thank you, Representative Jordan, for catching that. He was excused that day. So all in favor of approving the minutes for March 16th, please say aye.
Aye.
Ayes have it. The motion's approved. Next thing on our agenda is the House File 1872, and I thought I saw Representative Hollins.
I did, too.
And I'll move 1872 to have in front of us, and we're going to lay this over. So, Representative Hollins, you want to explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, committee members. Sorry for being slow getting up here.
It's that time of year and 100 things going on at once. And
it is one of those days. Yep. Okay. So thank you. House File 1872 provides building and permitting standards for churches, synagogues, and mosques and other places of worship to create communities of tiny homes on their property for unhoused people. We call them sacred settlements. And through these sacred settlements, faith congregations provide housing, supportive community, and stability to people experiencing chronic homelessness. This model was developed for the nonprofit Settled as the result of research from the University of Minnesota. It provides permanent housing to residents as opposed to other models that focus on temporary housing solutions. Settled's approach recognizes that these individuals have often experienced significant trauma and need restoration. It's based on a community-first model, inviting people into a loving, supportive environment. People transitioning out of homelessness live alongside individuals who choose to leave their current housing to provide support and stability to the settlement, known as intentional neighbors. Through this community of caring peers, people are able to find healing, safety, and peace. So each of these micro units, otherwise known as tiny homes, can be built on site at any faith community that wants to be a part of the project and then move to a place of worship that is creating one of these settlements. As of now, the type of tiny home used for sacred settlements would fall under the recreational vehicle designation and statute because they're built on wheels to be moved to their permanent locations. Under Minnesota law, recreational vehicles are not permitted as permanent form of housing. So this bill clarifies that these tiny homes can serve as permanent housing on congregational property. It also provides a set of building, sanitation, spacing, and setback standards for faith communities interested in providing this type of housing. The dwellings are not fully plumbed and must be under 400 square feet, but a community space with full bathrooms, shower, a laundry room, and a kitchen is available at the congregation's main building. Mm-hmm. The residents are offered their own permanent home, many for the first time, so long as they pay a nominal rent and follow the rules set out by the Good Neighbor Lease Agreement. This lease is mutually protective as it provides for safety of the community as a whole and allows residents security in their home when not being contingent on the relationship with the settlement's congregation. I have one of these tiny home settlements just down the road from my house, and I can say with a lot of certainty that it has been a fantastic addition to our neighborhood. We have, you know, we've got a great relationship with the church that is housing these individuals, and I'm really excited to be bringing this bill. I also want to note that I actually had Representative New Brindley, who carried this bill previously, and she was going to come testify with me but was unable to be here. I have several testifiers who are available, and I'd like to make sure they have time to say their whole piece.
And before we get to the testifiers, there's an A1 amendment. Do you want us to put that on?
Yes, please.
I'll move the A1 amendment. If you want to explain what that does.
I should have it in front of me. I believe the A1 amendment is a couple of technical changes that we made in conjunction with the League of Minnesota Cities, some of the requests that they had to tighten up the language. And so there were just, you know, agreements that we came to on this.
Members, any questions about that? Representative Myers?
Thank you, Chair Nelson. I do want to thank the advocates for making this change. I actually spoke with them earlier about it and defining religious institutions, so thank you for considering that.
With that, all in favor of the A1 amendment to put it in the order the author would like, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion's approved. We'll get to your testifiers. I have Valerie Roy on the list.
Okay. Actually, we have a different order.
Okay.
If that's okay.
Mr.
Please
Chair,
identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Krisnick, and I'm with Settled. And I want to do a quick technical walkthrough of the bill and talk about some of the key provisions. But I first want to thank Representative Hollins for touring the community, for offering the bill. We have several of the co-authors, Representative Meckland, Representative Jordan, Representative Daniels, they don't see, so I want to thank them for that. This is a true bipartisan effort, which is always nice to see. Just to walk through the bill, if you look at the definitions, kind of the definitions show the key aspects of the bill. The first, the definition of chronic homelessness, we use the federal definition, which requires that someone has been homeless for a year or more, or repeatedly homeless over a period of, repeatedly homeless over the last 3 years for four or more times adding up to that year. And it also requires that someone have a disability. So this is a very limited bill. It's focused very specifically on this population that often feels very pushed aside and has suffered really profound loss of relationship and community. And so this model is really designed to address that specific group. The designated volunteers, as Representative Hollins mentioned, are people like you and I who are choosing to live in community with those that really need friendly neighbors and supportive people around them. They aren't social workers. They still have regular jobs. They do have training in de-escalation and trauma, but they are there to be supportive and friendly. Extremely low income is pretty self-evident. And then the micro unit is the tiny home. So if you have questions on other definitions, I'm happy to talk about them. But really what the bill does starts on subdivision 2 on the top of page 2, that it allows, if you meet the requirements of the provision, it allows a faith community such as a church, synagogue, mosque, to create a community like this on their property. And we know that churches don't often have a lot of money. Synagogues and mosques may struggle with things, but they have land and they have real commitment to help their neighbor. Subdivision 3 is the basic requirements for the home, and much of this was written. The provisions were added at the request of the League of Minnesota Cities, who we approached even prior to taking the bill to anyone from Senator House Counsel, the revisor's office. So they talk about things like heat and water and electricity and an emergency plan for weather and those kind of things. But I want to just highlight two of them. On line 2.15, there's a requirement that the micro units be appropriately insured. And in the letter from the League, they expressed some concern about that not being specific enough. We didn't put a specific dollar amount there because that's really going to depend on what the size of the location is. The existing settlement, which hopefully you all have these beautiful pictures in your packet with our handout. This shows the existing Sacred Community in St. Paul is 6 homes. In two of them live the intentional neighbors, and in the other 4 live 5 people who were previously living in the street or in their car or in one place in a shed. In another community, they're looking at a community of 18 units focusing on veterans experiencing homelessness. and the insurance for those would be very vastly different. So we will certainly be talking with any of those faith communities to make sure there's adequate insurance to replace the homes themselves, any common areas in the faith community's building, and for rehoming the cost of someone who may have been displaced. I also want to just comment on 2.28 and 2.9. This is what we talk about is our good neighbor agreement, but it's a lease agreement, just making clear that both the religious organization and the residents have the full protection of landlord-tenant law. And then I want to add there's one amendment, technical amendment, that's currently still being drafted, and that's at the request of the League of Minnesota Cities that they would ask that the religious community would annually certify to the city that they have met the requirements of the statute and how that's done. So we are supportive of that. When you get to 2.30, subdivision 4, these are really technical construction pieces, and they were put together with the work of our general contractor, staff from the League of Minnesota Cities, as well as the Department of Labor and Industry, and working with the National Tiny Home Association. So if you have questions on any of those, I'm going to defer those to our general contractor, Brandon, who is here. But if you look them over and you're familiar with construction, you'll see that these are residential standards or higher, especially the insulation, looking at Minnesota winters, so really high insulation factors. I'm open to any questions. I urge you to approve this bill and really thank the co-authors and really all the people that we met with for your willingness to really look at the need for many solutions to address homelessness in our state and recognition of the unique needs of people who are living out of chronic homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Well, again, the next person I have is Valerie Roy.
Actually, it's Leah.
Representative Hollins, how many more testifiers they have? Because we've got other bills that we have to get through, and I don't want to have, don't need, I want to make sure people, we get to stay on time here.
Okay. So, Leah and then Valerie.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Leah Patton. I am the executive director of the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Our coalition is a statewide organization formed through the partnership of four sponsoring faith organizations, the Islamic Center of Minnesota, the Jewish Community Relations Council, the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and the Minnesota Council of Churches. So when Settled came to us a few years back now with this proposal, we jumped at the chance to advocate for this because of how well it meshes with all of our faith traditions. All of our faith traditions believe shelter, safety, and care for unhoused people is what we're commanded to do by God. In Islam, the Hadith on the rights of neighbors records the prophet saying, "He is not a believer whose stomach is filled while his neighbor goes hungry." In the Jewish tradition, the Midrash Tanayin on Numbers 28:2 teaches, God said to Israel, "My children, whenever you provide sustenance to those in need, I credit it to you as though you gave sustenance to me." And in the Christian tradition, in Matthew 6:26, Christ tells his followers, "Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they?" We're called to be vessels of divine grace, and a large part of that is sheltering people who need shelter and providing them with a caring, empathetic, loving community, as, again, we are called to do. Because being unhoused is not purely not having, it's not just not having a roof over your head, it's oftentimes not having a support system that can help you and lift you up when you're going through a hard time. So Settled's approach not only provides physical shelter, but it also provides that spiritual and just empathetic shelter as well. As mentioned, this bill is the result of over 2 years of working with the League of Cities to make sure that we're meeting standards, to make sure everybody has a healthy and safe home. And we want to thank them for all the work that they've done with that. We understand that the cities would like an opt-out provision in this bill. And we understand their reasoning for that, but that's something that we can't agree to. And the reason is that this model in particular provides a very cost-effective way for faith communities to live out their faith's mission. And again, it's a very foundational mission to all of our four traditions. And it's much more cost effective than other modes of housing, like building an addition onto a faith community building is just completely out of reach for most of our faith communities. So if we agreed to an opt-out, it would essentially say that a city could determine whether or not a faith community would be able to practice their faith in this way, and essentially it would prevent many faith communities from living out this foundational principle of their faith. So for us, this is a moral issue. If we can do something, we must do something according to our faith traditions, and we want to thank you for considering this bill. So.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, Valerie Roy. That's why we ask people to sign up ahead of time so we can get him on the list. And welcome
Mr.
to the
Chair,
committee. State your name for the tape and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of this community, I'm Valerie Roy, age 53, and I've lived half my life in vans, cars, and school buses. I've done everything to live right. I'm sober. At 42, I gained my BA, and never have I been convicted of a crime, had an eviction, or faced foreclosure. But unfortunately, that did not save me from being episodically short-term homeless between the ages of 12 to 25, and until now, 11 years long-term homeless. I had 2,600 resumes that have not procured professional work, and I've proved it's not what you know, it's who you know. Now, I live in a beautiful tiny home. I have access to the church, which I can use as an extension of my tiny home, and I have good neighbors. For the first time in 11 years, I have a community around me. Supported by this community, I have many more opportunities to network, to make friends, and to heal from trauma. This bill would create an opportunity for many other Minnesotans who currently live in cars, but worse, in tents. This tiny house opportunity has been life-changing. Thank you for your interest in finding solutions to chronic homelessness, especially since I would have faced another Minnesota winter in a van. I can only get better from here because living in a car is physically painful. My quality of life is on the rise. Now I'm valued in this community. I'm making friends and I have a new nickname. Before, I was forgotten and isolated. I'm glad you're interested in this model. It's a big step up from the nasty shelters. I thought I'd die in the old Dorothy Day shelter, as when I arrived, there was a bed lottery going on. This tiny house model is being considered all over the country, and I'm glad that our state, Minnesota, is interested in this deeply affordable housing model. It's made a big difference in my life to live in a stable home again. I hope in the future this can make the same changes for many others. Please support this bill. It will make life-saving changes for many people.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have another person on the list here, Tamala Walhoff.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tammy Walhoff. I'm the director of Lutheran Advocacy Minnesota. We are a ministry of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America and all six Minnesota ELCA synods, including almost 1,000 congregations. I'm here to speak in support of the bipartisan bill HF 1872, which some people call the Sacred Settlements Bill. We've been calling it the Sacred Tiny Home Communities Bill, because that's very descriptive of what it is. As stated in one of the church's messages on homelessness, God's love in Jesus Christ moves us to care for those experiencing homelessness as God cares for us all. We are called to walk with those experiencing homelessness. This tiny home bill, or communities bill, actually emphasizes a few different things that play specifically to the strengths of faith communities. One is community, this community first idea. Another is a focus on relationship. And a third is the focus on accompaniment with the intentional neighbors who join and live in these little tiny communities as well. There are many Lutheran churches that have been engaged in local ministries that work to serve people experiencing homelessness, whether it's volunteering or working with local organizations, hosting people to stay in their church for a week at a time along with other churches. But there is really a lot of enthusiasm for this model. We have a few churches that are already ready to say, you know, we'd like to have one of these communities on our property. One was already mentioned, the 18 home place for the veterans. And there are a couple of other places that are ready as well. We have resolutions that are passing in many of the conference assemblies across the state in preparation for Senate assemblies. A lot of interest and enthusiasm amongst churches, including in greater Minnesota. When I think of the affordable housing crisis in a place like Minnesota, it's a big, big problem. It's like a 1,000-piece puzzle. Lots of different groups and programs have different pieces of the puzzle. The pieces that the faith community can add are these pieces that focus on community, relationship, and accompaniment, and really plays to our strengths. It allows us to do what we do best. So I would encourage you to support this this bill, the bipartisan bill, HF 1872. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Now we'll go to discussion from the members. Any questions from the members? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have another testifier? But you're conducting the meeting, so I'll just ask my question.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. Just curious, we met earlier. We didn't represent it, but the folks that presented this and had some good discussions. And I think I asked this, and if I didn't, I'm asking it now. How long does a resident stay in this the dwelling? Are they able to stay for as long as they need, or is it open after a while for other folks that need housing as well?
Representative Holland or Ms. Krisnick.
The model is set up so that people may stay there permanently if that's their need. It would be wonderful if some of the people can move on and be in more stable housing and find stable employment. But for some of these people, they're really challenged with mental health issues and some other horrific background. So as long as they pay their nominal rent and follow the terms of the Good Neighbor lease agreement, these could be permanent homes for them.
Representative McDonald. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for bringing this. I know that there in the bill talks about you know, how many of these homes can be put based on the utilities they have. Have you talked to many churches that have thought about expanding or building more utilities? I'm just interested to see if you're in it. You know, if you've gotten some pre-buy-in from some of the churches to, you know, build onto their facility to help house these.
Representative Myers, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are churches that are looking at different ways to provide electricity, to provide plumbing. Plumbing in particular can be exorbitantly expensive. And so one of the great things about this model is a church could add a addition that would house 20 people, but it might cost $2 million. But because there's no government cost and all of this is donated, faith communities are able to do this. So it really is going to depend on the layout and how close things might be to the building, how they decide to do that. All of them are required to have electricity, and as I said, they're fully heated. Plumbing is the issue that some may include and some may not.
Representative Myers.
Yep, thank you for that. And, you know, as we discussed, you know, with my church, I think this is going to be a great thing that the, you know, the congregations and the groups are going to support and get behind us. So, Representative Hollins, thank you for bringing this bill.
And looking at this brochure that was handed out, these look like they're plumbed, the ones that are here. But I know in the bill it says either plumbing or a dry compostable toilets. But anyway, Representative Hossain.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Holland. And this is, looks great. This is a community, and this is what it should look like. How would people have access to this? You know, would they have to go to their mosque, or would they have to go to their church? You know, like the whole homeless people, how would they have this great information to, you know, to have access?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much, Chair and Representative Hussein. So the first thing I will say, and I'll let my testifier answer more thoroughly, but what I will say is there's no requirement to be a member of that church or that mosque or that synagogue. Folks come to these programs from all different
areas and walks of life. I know that the young lady that I met when I was touring had been in an encampment and was referred to the church that was already doing this work, and that's how she got connected with them. And so I know that's one of the concerns that I've heard from some folks, like, do you have to be a member of that church to participate in this? No, you do not. And I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, that is all true. And in addition, the way that Settle looks at this is once a faith community decides that they want to do this, they work with advocates for people experiencing homelessness in the area to figure out who's already living there in their car, in the woods, in a shed, and whatever it might be, to get to know them. And if people already have connections in the community, we certainly want to keep them. One of the testifiers, Todd Feske from Walking with Purpose, will address that. But can we keep people in the community where they may already have ties and then figure out who will be the residents? So that's the model that we've used.
Representative Hussein.
I mean, we do have a housing crisis in the state of Minnesota. And when it comes to housing crisis, we are the worst in the nations. And this will address a lot of people. And that also I want to follow up, would these people stay forever, or would they will be able to help them get their feet back and, you know, get their job back and get their other lives together?
And Representative Hollins, I think that was already answered, but go ahead.
Sure, I'll be brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. So they absolutely can stay indefinitely. Of course, our goal is that individuals get the support and help that they need to find more permanent housing, like an apartment or someplace like that. But it is designed to be permanent housing if folks need it to be.
Representative Zane.
Thank you. It's a great bill. I'm supporting.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, and Representative Hollins for bringing this bill forward. I think as we're facing a huge housing crisis, every creative and innovative solution needs to be on the table. I come from a community that has been writing and encouraging the passing of this bill. We have many faith communities and cultural groups actually actively working, and shout out to our Stepping On Up group that has brought forward something similar with our Churches United in Ministry and Safe Bay Parking for folks. To be able to come together, we know that the communal living is so important, and being able to have the partnership between the cities and the counties and our faith communities has been really important. And, you know, we need, they're all legs of the stool for how we address this crisis. We actually had a city council member who passed away, and have to shout her out, President Renee Van Nett, who actually had a yurt in her backyard. We have our churches doing these similar programs with respite homes. And so my question for you is around, you know, it's really important for us to also de-risk for projects and for cities and counties. I know that we face some hurdles around, like, the gas and fire stove and whatnot. And I'm just curious if you could speak to how it is that you might be working with the different entities and the local fire departments and whatnot to make sure that you have everything that you need to actually be successful, and you don't run into roadblocks that either are state or local code, such as the gas and those types of things that are needed. Thank you.
Representative, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's our goal that all of these are considered a community asset, and we want to work really closely with those groups. So immediately we're going to build relationships with the police department, with the fire department. These are all heated with electricity, so that just takes that risk of flame away. But it is our goal to make sure that we are embedded in the community and people really are part of that. We will, you know, I don't know how else to answer that, but that's, you know, that's really a primary goal and mission of TUF.
Representative Kozlowski, you quick follow-up? Or
no, wonderful. That answers my question. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And with that, members, we'll lay this bill over, and thank you for your testimony, and thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you.
The next bill we have on our agenda is House File 2164.
Lawmakers, I hope he has an answer.
What?
Representative Kraft. I'll move House File 2164 to be in front of us. And with that, members, this is, we're also going to be laying this bill over. So, Representative Kraft, we have an amendment.
We do.
Do we need to put that amendment out first?
Yes, please.
It's to delete everything. Sure. So, yes, I'll move the DE1 amendment for House 2164. All those in, this is to put the bill in the order the chair or the author wants. All in favor of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill's in the order you want. Representative McDonald, do you want to, or Representative Kraft, do you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. It's nice to be back here. This is a bill about consumer protection. The Contractor Recovery Fund was created by the legislature in 1994 to compensate homeowners who lost money because of unscrupulous building contractors engaging in fraudulent business practices. Since the beginning, the fund was limited to licensed residential building contractors and remodelers. This includes carpenters, floor installers, masonry workers, roofers, and others who contract to do work on residential properties. These folks pay into the fund annually. This bill was actually initiated several years ago, actually in 2017, when a bad actor, Able Energy, ripped off a bunch of homeowners around the state, went bankrupt, and left the homeowners with no way of getting any of their money back. This bill addresses that situation by requiring solar installers to be certified as residential contractors and thereby paying into the Contractor Recovery Fund. This makes sense because solar installers need to penetrate the roof to install solar panels. Hold on a minute.
Representative Kraft, keep going.
Yeah, okay. So, bill addressed the situation requiring solar installers to be installed, to be certified. It makes sense because solar installers need to penetrate the roof to install solar panels. This is a common sense bill that will also help consumers have more peace of mind when installing solar. I've done a lot of stakeholder engagement on this bill, and you can see support from groups like Housing First, the National Electrical Contractors Association, and also MNCEA is here to answer questions if that's desired. I also want to thank the several of folks that lost money to Able Energy that wrote letters here, specifically Judy Gibbs, Lowell Larson, and Sean Wentz, for sharing their stories and how they each lost thousands of dollars. They've all persisted over many years, and as soon as I contacted them, were willing to write letters or even come down here to testify. I want to point out that if this legislation had been in place back then, they probably would have been able to get all or a good portion of their money back from the fund. With that, I'll turn it over to the testifier here.
And this is Sean O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Sean O'Neill. I serve as the investigation supervisor for the Department of Labor and Industries Construction Codes and Licensing Division. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 2164, a bill that would require solar installers to be licensed as residential building contractors or remodelers. Installations of residential solar photovoltaic or PV systems has increased significantly over the past few years due to increases in technology, the reduction in the cost of the PV systems, and financial incentives offered by electric utilities. Currently, solar contractors that contract to install PV systems are not required to be licensed as a residential building contractor. Some solar contractors, however, do maintain dual licensure. For example, XL Energy Solar Rewards Program requires residential building contractors and solar installers to maintain dual licensure for that purpose of having access to the Contractor Recovery Fund. The electrical contractors that install the PV systems on roofs often don't have the engineering and the know-how in regards to roof loads and structure requirements as far as the additional weight that solar PV systems put on the roof. So having this adjustment or this modification to have the solar contractors licensed as residential building contractors makes sense. Licensed residential building contractors and remodelers pay into the recovery fund. The recovery fund exists to compensate homeowners who suffer a financial loss as a result of a residential building contractor's misconduct. by law, the recovery fund can pay out up to $550,000 collectively per license if we've got multiple homeowners making claims against one licensed contractor. And each homeowner would be able to receive up to $75,000 in compensation if they suffer a loss at the hands of a licensed residential building contractor. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify on House File 2164, and I will stand for questions.
With that, questions for the members. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Don't hurt your arm putting up that fence.
so excited. Thank you, Mr. Kraft. I carried this bill or very similar to it last year. I just want to clarify one thing in the original bill language. You had the part about that sections 1 and 2 are effective retroactively from January 1st, 2016, and it does not appear anywhere in your delete all, so I'm guessing you have completely eliminated that language.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mecklen, yes.
There was my big question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's
it. Any further questions? If not, thank you for your time. We'll lay this bill over and for possible inclusion.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, we did the amendment. And next bill we have is Representative Daniels, and I understand Representative McDonald's going to present it from Representative Daniels. And I'll move this bill to have it in front of us. The intent is to lay this one over also. So Representative McDonald, you want to present the bill.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you so much.
There's an email.
Thanks for nothing, Representative Daniels.
And I understand there's a DE amendment. I'll move the DE1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
All in favor of the DE1 amendment to put it in the order the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, Representative McDonald.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Well, this bill has been in this committee before, and Representative Bob Detmer, for those of you who remember, was the author originally, but he couldn't carry it past the finish line, but we expect that Representative Daniels, who is a member of this committee, will be able to do so. And we'll let Representative Detmer know, right, Mr. Chair? So basically, in summary, this exempts new buildings that are no more than 6 stories tall and have a roof slope of greater than 4 units vertical by 12 horizontal from being required to have dedicated anchorages by window cleaning. So this is also known as the window cleaning bill. So far, there's all peace in the valley with all. And I will just read a description of what the bill does so you have a better idea so you can vote yes. Right, Representative? This agreed-upon language with the Department of Labor and Industry allows DALI to adopt rules using the expedited rulemaking process in Section 14.389, very important state statute. The rules will require window cleaning safety features that comply with a nationally recognized standard as part of the new building code. Window cleaning safety features shall be provided for all windows on new buildings that were determined by the code and existing buildings undergoing alterations where both the following conditions are met, and they are windows that do not currently have safe window cleaning features, which is in many buildings, and the proposed work area being altered can include provisions for safe window cleaning. The bill was first introduced in 2020, as I said, by Representative Bob Detmer. A contractor in Representative Detmer's district was required to install, at a cost of $85,000 to $100,000, an anchoring system for window cleaning. That due in the slope of the roof of the project. That makes sense? That in due part to the slope of the roof in the project would never be able to be used by window cleaners, hence the new bill. This was the result of an interpretation made by the city building inspector and addressed an area of the state building code by DALI, recognized a problem because it was requiring installation of a dedicated anchoring system that could never be utilized for its intended purpose. 3 years later, while we still do not have a direct answer or situation presented,
Dolly did agree to this issue and will seek and provide clarity for all contractors. We hope that in the future, money will not have to be spent on items where there is no safety issue or other defined benefit to require it. This is just good governance, good, safe cleaning windows, and I'm sure you're all in agreement. We want to see out windows and have them safely cleaned at the same time. Mr. Chair, I yield for questions.
And I have Greg Metz from Manager Construction Plan Review. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Greg Metz. I'm a senior manager of the Department of Labor and Industry overseeing construction codes rulemaking and the plan review or construction code interpretation side of code enforcement. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We're pleased to support House File 2104 as amended. By way of background, a window cleaning safety advisory committee was formed in 2010 to develop recommendations to reduce the number of fatalities from falls in the window cleaning industry. One result was that Minnesota Statute 326B was amended to require the state building code to mandate window cleaning roof anchoring systems to improve the safety of window washing for suspended window washing. In 2012, the current requirement was passed into law by the legislature and incorporated into the state building code in 2015. Since that time, the department has received many inquiries from developers seeking an exemption from the statutory requirement due to cost of installing the anchorages and the impracticality of their use on certain buildings with pitched roofs because of the overhangs. Although the current statute specifically allows the commissioner to waive all or a portion of the window cleaning anchor requirements related to reconstruction, alteration, or repair of existing buildings, the same authority is not provided for new buildings. In addition, there are nationally recognized window cleaning safety standards that recognize up to 8 different safe window cleaning methods, many of which do not require suspension or cleaning anchors. Because of the requirement for window cleaning anchors is written directly into statute, building officials do not have rule interpretation authority to approve alternative designs for safe window cleaning, which are found in the National Window Cleaning Safety Standards. The commissioner does not have the authority to waive this requirement, and a statutory change is needed. Last year, the Construction Codes Advisory Council, a 20-member council comprised of technical experts in the construction industry charged with reviewing laws, codes, rules, and standards related to building construction, formed a technical advisory group, or TAG, to review a bill identical to House File 2104. The TAG discussed building maintenance features, cleaning methods, and worker safety. Rather than establishing one particular method of window cleaning, such as suspended anchors required in law, the TAG unanimously recommended language that would require the commissioner to adopt via rulemaking a national window cleaning safety standard into the state building code that would permit multiple safe window cleaning methods. This approach would give the building owners maximum flexibility on selecting the method of window cleaning that is appropriate for their building while ensuring window cleaning worker safety. The language was agreed to by the represented industries and window cleaning union representatives last session and is included in DLI's budget bill this year. That language is included in the latest amendment version of this bill, and I'd like to thank Representative Daniels for supporting the amended language.
Thank you, sir. Any questions on the bill from the membership? I know this bill's been around for a while. I know there's the issue about whether they're safe, some of these are safe and not, but I'm glad we finally got it worked out. So, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Dolly. Thank you for being here. Have you talked, how are people employed in window washing feeling about this bill and these proposed changes? And can you talk about some of the engagement that's happened with them over this bill?
Mr. Metz.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. We had a technical advisory group that we convened last year. We had 2 representatives from the window cleaning union that sat on the technical advisory group, and they provided their input into this, and they're more than happy with the direction that this went.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish some of those workers were here to ask them that question. So I will plan on doing that before we include this in an omnibus bill. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, Representative Daniels got off easy.
Yes, I'll say he did, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Thank you, Representative Jordan, for asking that question. It was good to know that there was, as Representative Davis said, he coined the phrase a number of years ago, peace in the valley. And I think that's important that we know that's the case. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I ask for your support.
And with that, members, we're going to lay this bill over. And thank you for doing that for Representative McCann.
You're very welcome.
The last bill we have on our agenda. Oh, there she is. Yeah, Representative Feist. I didn't see you. That's why. Is House File 1700? And I'll have the move the bill to be in front of us. I'll move House File 1700 so the bill's in front of us. And Representative Feist, do we have? There's an amendment. A6 amendment. You want to? I'll move the A6 amendment. And you explain what the amendment is briefly.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, which I don't have the exact language in front of me, but it's just making certain things that said must into may and penalties that were an exact amount into up to, I believe, unless I'm thinking of the complete wrong bill, but I'm pretty sure.
Kind of what this looks like. Yeah.
Perfect.
So all in favor of the A2 or A6 amendment, put it in the order that the chair or the author wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. With that, proceed with your the part of the bill that's in front of us, which I believe is the retaliation piece. And can you point that out, where that's at for us?
Yes, absolutely. It is full of two sections. So section 6, subdivision 9, page 10, lines 1027 through 1030. That is the first section. Then on section 9, subdivision 6, page 14, lines 1410 through 1412.
Explain those provisions, ma'am.
You don't want the whole speech about how
I don't need the whole bill. No, we're just here for the retaliation piece, which was in our purview.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1700 is the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. It is to address the unacceptable status quo where both nurses and hospitals are struggling. I will spare you impassioned speech and just let you know that this is a really important step that nurses have been trying to take for many years. And the retaliation portions are new this year, which is why we are here in labor for the first time. And they will just ensure that nurses don't suffer a chilling effect from raising issues of unsafe staffing in hospitals. And so this creates a right of protections from retaliation by hospitals, which we know is an issue.
Thank you. I see we have some testifiers, and hopefully we got them in the right order on this one. I have a Mary McGibbon. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary McGibbon. I have been a bedside nurse at Methodist Hospital for 27 years. And most of the 27 years I've been involved with some sort of committee work in my facility, because I believe that we can work to move things forward for our patients and for our staff. I've been an M&A chair at my facility since 2012. At Methodist Hospital, we have a staffing committee where we do review concerns for safe staffing that are filed in the hospital and through the M&A website. We look for root causes for these concerns, which all too often is because of not enough staff. But that's where it's left. That's where it's left in the committee. There's no solutions, there's no follow through. It's just where it is. Committee work has been put on hold. None of our committees have met since last February due to negotiations. Other times when committee work is happening, they get postponed. And most recently, we finished our contract negotiation in December, and it's still 3 months and we have yet to meet. As a co-chair of this staffing committee, I talk to my nurses all the time. As a chair, I talk to my nurses all the time. I asked my colleagues over the weekend, because I worked this past weekend, what prevented them from filling out concerns. And overwhelmingly, people just don't want to be targeted by management. And when I asked them, what do you mean targeted? And I was told it's all about the retaliation. Well, you got to explain to me. What do you mean retaliation? Multiple nurses told me that they had their schedules changed the next time it came out. After years of working a certain schedule, it gets changed. An example, another example, being taken off of a charge nurse shift, which is actually a financial hit, if you think about it, because there is a pay differential. Other nurses have had vacations denied, and then some have been removed from committee work. All of this kind of things make it harder for nurses to want to speak up due to the culture of fear that's been created by management. Many of you have heard from your nurse constituents over the past decades, because I've been coming. Our employer has failed to include nurses and other bedside nurses, workers in staffing decisions that would benefit our patients and our profession. During the negotiation process, we had discussions on how short our staffing was and various solutions that M&A members, the negotiating team, brought forward. The response from our critical care directors sitting on the other side of the table is, what is M&A doing about staffing? So here I am, here we are, again, trying to do something about this. As nurses, we are held accountable for the patient care that we provide, even if we aren't provided the time and resources to ensure quality patient care. I'm asking that you listen to those of us at the bedside, as we are the experts when it comes to caring for our patients. Our hospital leaders fail to be accountable to our patients, and with your help, hopefully that will change for the future of Minnesotans and the future of our nursing profession. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person I have on my list is Carrie Mortrude. And then after that, I have Mary Beth Olson. You can get ready. Be ready.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Carrie Mortrude, and I gave up bedside nursing over 18 years ago for one reason: because I couldn't safely care for my patients. Hospital bedside nurses are in crisis. They are here pleading for the real solutions that the Keeping the Nurses at the Bedside Act provides. They are here to ask you specifically for your support to provide them the safety and security they need to do their jobs. There are many studies that demonstrate better nurse staffing in hospitals leads to better outcomes. Increasing the number of patients per nurse is commonly associated with higher rates of negative outcomes, such as pneumonia, shock, urinary tract infections, and even cardiac arrest. Yet shift after shift, as nurses appeal to nurse leaders for help with seriously unsafe staffing, they are often met with indifference. Many of you have asked the nurses to deal with this at the negotiating table. However, contract cycle after cycle, nurses are met with statements such as, "We will never negotiate overstaffing. We will have to be forced to do so." The Nurse Practice Act requires nurses to deliver safe and effective care, despite not having any decision-making authority to determine just how many nurses are required to provide that safe and effective care. Nurses can be disciplined from the licensing board for just putting a patient at risk. Minnesota Statute 148-261 explains that a negative outcome to a patient doesn't even have to occur for a nurse to be disciplined. You may hear from the opposition that staffing legislation doesn't work. Yet there are many states that have legislated nurse staffing committees. And even in California, the state with mandated ratios, the RN vacancies are lower, were lower than the nation from 2017 to 2021. And compared to Minnesota, their vacancy rate was significantly lower than ours in 2021. Nurses in California also tend to work full-time due to better working conditions with regard to safe staffing. In 2020, 63% of California nurses worked in full-time positions, with only 32% of Minnesota nurses doing the same. The old way of doing things isn't working. Over 2,400 nurses left Minnesota hospitals last year. We are here presenting a solution to the retention issue. The work environment must change in order to keep nurses at the bedside. How many nurses must be disciplined for advocating for their patients before the nurses are heard? How many nurses must leave before they are heard? And finally, how many patients must suffer substandard or even seriously unsafe staffing before the nurses are heard? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mary Beth Olson, and after that I have Sarah Gabrick.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mary Beth Olson, and I'm the Vice President of Acute Care Nursing Operations for Alliant Health. My responsibilities include developing strategies to address the acute care RN workforce shortage. Prior to this role, I was the Chief Nursing Officer at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids and United Hospital in St. Paul. I have over 39 years' experience working as a nurse. My experience at the bedside includes med-surg nursing, critical care, and the operating room. Article 2 of this bill would compromise access and the quality of care for Minnesota patients, would ultimately lead to hospital units being closed and patients backing up further in our emergency departments. Today I'm going to speak specifically to the part of the bill concerning safe staffing forms and retaliation. We use the concern for safe staffing forms at Alina, and I can tell you retaliation is never part of the equation. When the forms are sent to from MNA to us, they currently are anonymous with the name removed. We use the forms to look for trends and issues we can address, but they do not address the actual issue in real time. Alina Health is a high reliability organization which emphasizes a speak up culture. We encourage our nurses to bring concerns forward in real time so we can immediately address the issue, not wait until after the fact to understand what the concern is and what can be done about it. In our most recent contract negotiations with MNA, in addition to the high reliability organizational skills we use across the organization, we actually agreed to an actual additional formal process to bring concerns forward in real time, as well as a process for escalation in real time to be able to deal with the issue. If the nurse is not satisfied with the response they get from their charge nurse, this escalation process allows the nurse to further problem solve real time to address the issue. We're working continuously as an organization to recruit and retain the nursing professionals we have on staff. They are an integral member of our care teams, and we're committed to providing our nurses with the support and resources they need to thrive in their careers. A transparent and efficient process for dealing with safe staffing concerns is one way we're providing that support. Other retention efforts include compensation, that's among the highest in the nation, flexible scheduling to support balanced lives, and just a note, the majority of our hospital RNs are now working part-time. Receiving bonuses, and our organization is committed to improving the safety of our care teams. We deeply value and respect the critical role that nursing professions play in the delivery of high-quality care to patients. An arbitration approach to determining staffing will not encourage a healthy culture for our care teams, nor will it bring back nurses to the bedside, nor solve the current RN workforce shortage. An arbitrator is not a staffing expert. The current challenge is not our unwillingness to hire nurses, as evidenced by the current number of open RN positions. It is a lack of available workforce. We continue to support our nurses with the use of very high cost agency staffing. We'd much prefer to hire our own nurses, and we continue to be creative in sourcing options to fill our open positions. Thank you for the opportunity to address my concerns with the committee. Thank you.
Sarah Gabrick, and then I have Mary Crink. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sarah Gabrick. I am the Chief Nursing Officer for Winona Health. I have been a registered nurse for 37 years, 12 of those in direct patient care. We are a 49-bed rural hospital with an MNA collective bargaining agreement. We strongly oppose Article 2 of this bill, as it threatens to replace our existing staffing process with a divisive one-size-fits-all legislative mandate. We already have a long-standing process for real-time collaborative review of staffing concerns. Our approach empowers nurses and all team members to speak up in the moment and work together for real-time solutions. We need flexibility to adjust staffing as patient needs change. Timely, transparent communication between our charge nurses, frontline nurses, other care team members, and leadership is when requested is essential for fostering real-time staffing decisions which support our team culture. At Winona Health, we have an ethical and regulatory obligation to practice and promote just culture, which includes speaking up for safety. We welcome, encourage, and appreciate staff speaking up, and our code of conduct prohibits retaliation. While the retaliation provisions of this bill undermine our culture, they are by no means the worst part of this bill. Article 2 compromises patient care by mandating staffing ratios. Every Minnesotan needing hospital care will be reduced to a number. And if the equation of patients and nurses doesn't add up to an arbitrated number, some Minnesotans will be denied timely access to care. For our community, the next nearest hospital is 30 miles away. If inflexible staffing ratios are mandated, hospitals will be forced to close units and reduce the services they can provide to our communities. Another priority for Minnesota hospitals is to ensure equity for all patients. Article 2 does not align with that goal. Please oppose Article 2 of this bill. Thank you.
And Mary Krinke. And then we'll open up to questions. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. My testimony today will focus on the sections of the bill regarding the Department of Labor and Industry and the newly proposed fines prohibiting actions deemed to be in retaliation against nurses. This is found in two places in the bill, Article 2, Section 6, and Subdivision 9. This is in regards to submitting a concern for safe staffing form. In the hospitals with M&A collective bargaining agreements, these forms are usually submitted to the M&A, and sometimes the forms are then forwarded to nursing leadership. We do not believe there is retaliation for the submission of these forms. Hospitals usually have a process of reviewing the forms. The troubling aspect of this language in the bill is that it calls for a fine of up to $250,000. That is a lot of money for a small rural hospital, so we just think that fee is excessively high. Article 2, Section 9 prohibits retaliation against a nurse for refusing to accept a patient assignment. Once again, we do not believe there is retaliation by hospitals or nurse leadership against a nurse for doing this. Refusal to accept a patient, however, is not a good practice. I would like to point out that physicians, no matter how tired they are, they will stay in the emergency room working regardless of how tired they are. They will not refuse to accept a patient. The identified best practice is for a nurse to go to their charge nurse, their direct supervisor, and then the chief nursing officer to identify additional resources that may be needed. This could include additional staffing or additional training. Nurse leaders may need to pull nurses from other units, from clinics, or call additional nurses to come in and help. This is referred to as using the chain of command. Hospitals usually have an identified process for this. We do not support putting this language in statute that could imply that refusing to accept a patient is encouraged behavior. MHA supports articles and many articles and provisions in this bill. Hospitals want to work collaboratively with all of our care teams on reducing workplace violence, supporting loan forgiveness for nurses, and for the mental health provisions that are in this bill. Our opposition and concerns are all in Article 2, which contains the numerous staffing mandates, including the staffing ratios determined by the committees, and the legally binding arbitration if staffing decisions cannot be made. I just want to close by sharing with you all, this is the editorial that was in this past Sunday's Star Tribune article. It basically says, caution on staffing reforms, and it talks about the dire financial situation of hospitals as well as our workforce shortages that we have right now. There are over 5,000 open RN positions in Minnesota, and hospitals are working hard every day to fill the RN positions that they have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Now, questions of the discussion of the bill? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a particular question maybe for Mrs. Krinke. She was...
Ms. Krinke, if you want to come back, I think he has a question for you. Representative McDonald. And again, the parts of the bill that are, comply with us are on page 10, 10.21 to 10.26, and on page 14, 14.10 to 14.12, the two parts dealing with retaliation.
Mr. Chair, yes, with all due respect, however, because a lot of the testifiers did testify about staffing ratios and the safety issues, I think that would probably be an important element to bring up, since that was the bulk kind of our safety.
I understand, Representative Donald, but this will give a little leeway, but this is these are the reason why the bill is here in front of us. And again, the intention is to lay this over. It's not going to be in our bill, but there's these are the it's here because we need to hear these parts, because that's what Dolly has to deal with. So, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Krinke, I have a question regarding a provision. Yes, I highlighted it, so give me just a moment. There it is. Particularly on page 21, article subsection 15, 21.717 to 21.20, in particularly addressing the disclosure of action plans, which is in state law right now. Hospitals must include law enforcement for an action plan. I think that's probably a very good provision. So my first question is, in her in Representative Feist's bill, she strikes the word law enforcement. They evidently want nothing to do with them in here, and it says all direct care staff. So I was just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Can you repeat the page and line numbers you're talking
page
about?
Page 21 of the bill, section 21.17. down to 21.20. And this question is to Ms. Krinke.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, in 2015, we worked collaboratively with the Minnesota Nurses Association on violence prevention legislation. And at that time, hospitals were mandated to have a violence prevention action plan in place, and we share those action plans with our employees, and we also share them as requested with local law enforcement. And our hospitals encourage them to have a very good relationship with local law enforcement. They can come in quickly if they're called, and they know our processes and procedures for safety. So we were a little surprised to see that that language was being struck out, considering it was something that we had worked on in 2015.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll comment generally, and then I can turn it over to someone with institutional knowledge. But in general, you know, this is about what is required, and this section, which we worked on with Ms. Krinke and appreciated her input on, is going to create a very robust action plan of addressing violence in hospitals, which is a very big issue. And so that may very well involve sharing information with local law enforcement. We're just not mandating it here. And I actually have someone who can answer with specificity about why this change was made.
If you want to identify yourself for the tape and proceed with the answer of the question.
Thank you, Chair. Katie Cottenbrook with the Minnesota Nurses Association. When we worked with the Minnesota Hospital Association on this particular line, they asked that we remove reporting these safety plans to the public, and we had removed law enforcement because they were going to everyone. It was just an oversight in the amendment, and we would be happy to make that change back to the way it was.
Representative McDonald, I think you kind of inferred that they didn't want law enforcement there, but I don't think that's the case. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, did I refer that? I was reading the bill, but that's not the case. Is that correct? Well, good.
Shaking their head no.
Yeah. So just, you know, in reading the article from the Star and Tribune, Representative Feist and maybe Ms. Krinke, regarding the staffing ratios and what this would do to our hospitals, especially rural hospitals, we are having a staffing ratio or a staffing shortages all over the country, and in particularly Minnesota, and particularly in the healthcare industry. the concerns that many have with your bill, and I'm no expert by any means a stretch of the imagination, although I've been around for 13 years and was on Health and Human Services for six of those years, I think. So I knew a little bit of modicum of some of the minutiae of the hospitals and the nurses and the doctors. I have, though, depended on the expertise of those in the industry, including family members who are nurses. I have three family members of nurses, and then also of Ms. Krinke. I have come to respect her and ask her advice and seek her counsel on many issues. And we've had some in-depth conversations regarding this bill. And the concerns are that with the shorting staffages already, this would only exacerbate that. And some of your provisions, Representative Feist, in your bill, for particularly this one here, isn't it something you got paperwork all over the place? Yeah, on page 10 of your bill, Representative Feist, and Representative, or Ms. Krinke, if you could just stay there for a moment. Section 10.1 down to 10.7. And this just seems so interesting. I want your advice on this or opinion. So it says, regarding the staffing ratio, the core ratio, before hospital management lowers the staffing level of any unit, management must consult with and receive agreement from at least 50% of the direct care registered nurses staffing the unit. Deviation from a core staffing plan with an agreement of 50% of the direct care registered nurses staffing the unit does not constitute compliance with the core staffing plans. So basically, since the committee is formed to consult and come up with a plan for staffing, should they not, it goes to arbitration. And then while that's going to arbitration, the hospital has to come up with a staffing ratio plan. So it seems very counterintuitive and in butting heads, really, in defeating the purpose of your bill.
And that's surely not a part of our overview of this bill, but quick answer, Representative Feist.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the questions. That is not how this bill would work. Ratios do exist. Hospitals use them in order to safely staff, ideally, their units. So this creates committees that would look at optimal staffing levels. It creates workload committees per unit, and they are going to do deep dives looking at patient acuity, level of experience for the various staff. And so those exist, they coincide with the individualized daily, hourly decisions that the on-the-ground staff need to make. And I would like to respond to the Star Tribune editorial, which interviewed a number of people who were not quoted in that article. They quoted one random person from Rhode Island, but they did not quote the person from California with whom they spoke, who shared a very different perspective. They also talked about how they would prefer to see an incremental approach, such as we took in 2013 in the legislature, requesting collection of data in order to show the correlation between safe staffing and patient outcomes. As a result of that law, the Department of Health was tasked with collecting data and looking at outcomes, looking at staffing. But then in 2014, the Minnesota Hospital Association sent out a letter to the Department of Health saying that they had advised all of their hospitals not to provide the necessary data for the Department of Health to do that study. And I do have copies of that letter if you'd like. A page could submit them to the committee. So, you know, we've tried an incremental approach. We've tried a lot of things. This bill and this effort has been around for a very long time. And I will say this was before Ms. Krinke was with the Hospital Association. But this is absolutely essential. And, you know, as I've said to every committee that I've been before and all of my colleagues, there's nothing magic about Article 2. It doesn't have to look exactly like it looks right now. The goal is to give nurses an actual voice in staffing. And there are 122,000 registered nurses in the state of Minnesota. That is an increase of 4,000 nurses from last year. There is not a nursing shortage. There is a shortage of nurses who are willing to work full-time at the bedside. And this bill is one way to address that, and I think it is absolutely essential that we do that.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, Representative.
Ms. Krinke, did you want to answer, respond, or?
Ms. Krinke, just.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, there's a lot to unpackage there, but for the record, I've been at the Minnesota Hospital Association for 21 years, so I was there during this 2014 discussion. And we had a compromise in 2013 that required the hospitals to submit data to the Minnesota Hospital Association on our staffing plans, and every quarter since then, they provide information that is posted on our website where you can look up the staffing numbers of nurses as well as other health professionals that work on a unit and compare that to the census. So in essence, it is a staffing grid, but that is very different than a mandated staffing ratio. So, and I just, if I can, clarify that study. The Department of Health asked our members to provide data by the shift. In other words, what do you have on every single shift? And that was not part of the law. And our members, maybe they should have provided that information, but they decided that because it was not part of the law, they were going to provide the data that was part of the law. Now, maybe that wasn't the right approach, but in retrospect at the time, they said, we're going to provide everything that the new law that just passed was required of us. So that's what it was. It's a great deal of work to provide shift level data. So it's so
anyway,
but a little, yeah.
Yeah, and I realized you were there back in 2014, but
yes, okay.
Mistakes get, you know, people make mistakes.
Right. Perfect. Yes.
Representative McDonald, one more question, then I'm going to move on to another person, and we'll get back to you.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Then this question is for Ms. Krinke as well. The patient care is the most important thing. We all know that. And the care of the nurses and the doctors and the RNs and the nursing aides, the doctors. It's a whole nursing care team that take care of the patient. My mother was just in the hospital for this 4 or 5 days. Now she's in recovery. And it takes a team to take care of them. The concern that I think I have heard from many is that with staffing ratios and the ability to nurses to veto a management of the hospital, who manage the hospital, veto what the most important things for patient care. Is there a potential with the staffing shortage that we're already experiencing that a patient could be admitted to a hospital and simply won't have the care that it's needed? The patient, the staffing ratios would prohibit. Let's say a patient, a nurse called in sick, wasn't able to make it, and this staffing ratio were in place. Is there a potential that that patient could be turned away for health care?
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, that is underlying our biggest concern with all of Article 2, that strict adherence to a staffing ratio, and if the hospital cannot find additional nurses either to hire or to come in, this language that you had pointed out would say that the nurses on that unit could be empowered to take a vote and not allow a patient to be admitted. So this section of the bill is one of our biggest concerns with the bill as it is written now.
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. This is what's happening now. The status quo is not working. Hospitals are understaffed. Patients are being turned away. They are being divided amongst too few nurses whose licenses are on the line and who, in the nurses' words, are suffering a moral injury because they are not able to fulfill their duties that they took a vow. I don't know if there's a vow for nurses, but like an oath. Thank you. You know, the status quo is not working. We have a problem. This is an opportunity to address it. The expectation is that out of those 122,000 nurses who are registered, who are in Minnesota, that we can bring them back to the bedside. I have spoken with nurses in my own district. I have a nurse constituent who left the bedside after 30 years. She had all of this wisdom and experience, but she said because her unit was so understaffed that patients or staff were being assaulted multiple times per week. So we know the status quo isn't working. This is a solution. I would love to work with stakeholders, with colleagues, to look, you know, in depth at Article 2, and you know, I'm very open, we are all very open to looking at the specific language, but this bill is not a one-size-fits-all bill. It's not a ratio bill. We do not allow a group of nurses on the unit to veto decisions by administration. Like, there are all very specific protocols in place in hospitals, in units,
I've got some musical accompaniment for this moment. So this is just overlays that. This doesn't replace it. And again, I just want to make it very clear, you know, the original version of this bill was ratios. This is not ratios. The next version of this bill was like a 60-40 split. So nurses had more control than administration on these committees to make decisions. That now is 50-50. And in fact, the nurses would be only 35% of that, with 15% being other bedside workers. So the idea is to create a collaborative decision-making process through these committees, where the people who are at the bedside, whose licenses are on the line, are going to have a voice and bring their expertise to these staffing decisions.
One last comment.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Yes, absolutely. There's some things that you said that I certainly agree with, and we do care and love our nurses. So to the patients, I encourage you, of course, this is your bill. I'm just one vote from Wright County. But I encourage you to continue to work with the shareholders, the nurses, the hospitals, Ms. Krinke, and all those who really understand this issue well. There is a certain legitimacy to the concern that with a ratio, we'll call it whatever you want, that the help won't be there when needed. And certainly we got to care about the nurses who are being overworked. I know my sister and niece and an aunt is one of them. I had a good friend that had a heart attack and waited 2 hours in the emergency room. A heart attack. Now, it wasn't the nurse's fault. It wasn't the doctor's fault. They just weren't staffed enough. I hope your bill does what you want it to do, but I have some heartburn that caused me to go to the doctor if it doesn't. So that's all I have to say.
And Representative McDonald, we all care for our nurses. And again, my mother was a nurse, so this is near and dear to my heart also. Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. Let me first just echo, you know, I've talked to a lot of people on this, and, you know, one thing I hear back from them is your willingness to talk with the stakeholders. I know we've worked on other bills together, so thank you for that. You know, we know from the deed report and the governor that, you know, there is a nursing shortage and that we've got to look at incentivizing our current and future nurses, caregivers, LPMs. You know, there are some good things in the bill as far as, you know, safety, incentivizing new nurses, retaining our current nurses that we have, as well as looking at some of the mental health concerns, the boarding concerns, patients staying in hospitals too long because they don't have other opportunities, other places to go to get the services they need. You know, the question I would have for you is, how is Article 2 that you have a better process than what Mayo, CentraCare, or these other hospitals have?
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the question. So we know that people are waiting for 2 hours when they show up at the hospital because they had a heart attack. We know that the current situation isn't working. You know, hospitals do have a process, and the process isn't meeting the needs of patients, and it's not meeting the needs of nurses. And that's why nurses are leaving the bedside. So what this process does and what Article 2 does, and there's nothing magic about the way it's structured, if other people have other ideas about how to do this, is it gives nurses a direct voice, and it gives them a voice without fear of retaliation, which if it's not an issue at hospitals, which I hope it's not an issue at most hospitals, then they don't need to worry about these fines. But where it is an issue, we see that there's sometimes a chilling effect when nurses do, you know, outside of this bill and this structure, and when nurses raise issues, they're oftentimes, like, we have concern for safe staffing forms that say that they were told that they would buy them a pizza, or that they would pray for them, or that they were thinking of them. You know, that's the type of responses that are all too common when nurses are raising these types of issues with management. So the idea here is to give nurses more of a voice and more power to really assert their expertise in the staffing process, and I truly do welcome input from stakeholders. I like the details. I am a nerd. I'm a lawyer. I like the minutiae of the bills, and I'm always willing to work with folks, and Mary is probably sick of me because we've had met for many hours about this bill, and I'm happy to continue those conversations.
Representative Myers.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I would just make sure, you know, again, you know, hearing from nurses, my wife was a nurse, as well as hearing from, you know, I had a couple administrative staff members from the hospitals in my office today to make sure that, you know, we are lining up together with those hospitals as well as those nurses. So if you could just keep continuing talking to those stakeholders, I think there is some changes that can be made, and I believe there will be some changes to Article 2. So thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Feist. It's always obvious, but especially with this bill, that you understand this very well. And I want to thank you for knowing that and writing a bill that really acknowledges that nurses' working conditions are patients' recuperative conditions. Nurses and patients, nurses are the ones who are taking care of patients. They're the closest ones. So, of course, when they're standing up for patients and they're standing up for their working conditions, they're standing up for all of our health. And I am really interested here in on page 10 in subdivision 9. There's reporting noncompliance that interests me, in that it says not only do employees seem to gain some ability to report, but there's also some patient or patient family members that have the ability to report noncompliance. Can you or one of your testifiers perhaps walk through what that would look like briefly with this bill, on what that would look like now for patients or their family members that wish to report an unsafe staffing condition in a hospital?
State your name again, and then you can answer the question.
Absolutely. Carrie Mortrude. Thank you, Chair Nelson, and thank you for the question. So, nurses today know that patients actually withhold their concerns because they don't want to then experience being ignored, left. They don't want their nurse to get in trouble. And so they will often say things to us as they're leaving. They actually know right now how short we are. There are patients in beds that are self-prioritizing based on what they see going on out in the hallway. They know that their bedmate in the bed next to them is more critical, so they won't tell me that they've been having chest pain for 10 minutes, even though they're on my cardiac unit, because they don't want to take care away from someone else. And so right now, the process is that there is a patient rep that they can talk with. There's a hospital person that they can speak with. But many times they're afraid that if they raise those concerns, that that will be retaliated against. And so we are trying to find a way where nurses, family members, other coworkers can come forward without that fear of retaliation in any form.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. I think that's one of those things that we always go through our minds as patients when we see something. I mean, I had a family member with a traumatic brain injury and even was concerned about the staffing ratios as he was bleeding from a broken skull. And so that was, that's something that I've experienced in my family, and I have to say that the nurses who took care of him did a great job. And I'm happy to stand with those nurses that have taken care of me and my family members for so long. So thank you for being here, and thank you, Representative Feist, for all your work.
And Representative Feist, do you have a final wrap-up? And then we're going to lay this bill over.
Thank you,
Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. This is a really important bill. I think we might disagree on solutions, but I think we can all agree that the status quo is not working. So this is a really important bill. It was brought to us by experts. It was brought to us by the nurses. And I think in that it needs to be considered in tandem with all of the bills that we're considering this session to support our healthcare systems, to support hospitals. This bill is incredibly important, and it's important not just to nurses and their working conditions, which is your purview, but also to patients, and that means all of us and our family members. So I urge your support. Thank you.
And with that, Representative Donald.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious, Representative Feist, get your input on this. But Mr. Chair, it's being laid over.
The bill is here for us to hear the retaliation pieces, and it's going to be it's going to be carried someplace else, but not in our bill. So we're hearing it came to us because of the retaliation pieces, and that's why we're laying it over. We heard that, and that's why we're laying it over.
So, Mr. Chair,
yep.
So I'm just curious, just looking at the flow in which it went in the Senate, that it's not they went to Commerce and Labor and Industry, or Commerce and also Judiciary. So I'm just wondering that you don't want this to go to Judiciary.
We had a discussion with Chair of Judiciary, and she said she looked at the bill and she said she doesn't need to see it.
Okay.
And with that, members, we'll lay the bill over. Thank you for the bill, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And with that, members, our next meeting is Thursday, and with that, we're adjourned.